Forum topic for tonight is how do you do food? Feasts, fasts, and food facts, with a special attention on the preparing and eating of food here in the village. To open the conversation, we have invited three Holden veteran residents, Gertrude Lundholm, who will conclude the opening remarks with some comments on fasting. Ethan Bergman, who is a veteran cook, and Will Mochan, formerly head cook here at Holden. And Will will open with the initial comments.
To start off, I'll tell you in a sentence what our plan is tonight, then you'll know where we're going, and basically I'll knock the way that most Americans eat, and then Ethan will tell you why Holden's food is so great. And then after that, we hope that Gertrude has some things to say about fasting that tie in. And then from that, I think some discussion and questions will develop. I'd like to start with a short poem. When we eat good bread, we are eating months of sunlight, weeks of rain and snow from the sky, richness out of the earth. We should be great, each of us, radiant, full of music and full of stories, able to run the way the clouds do, able to dance like the snow and the rain. But nobody takes time to think that he eats all these things, and that snow, sun, and rain are a part of himself. I think that we often, most of the time, we don't eat good bread, and we don't stop to think that snow and sun and rain can be a part of ourselves, and I think that as Americans, our lives are poor because we don't think of these things. Generally, I think the way we eat is poor both at home and out when we eat in restaurants. Both at home and in restaurants, we usually end up sacrificing quality and nutrition for the sake of speed and convenience. I think the sacrifice in the home is easily seen in supermarkets, which reflect our food patterns because the food that's there is there in response to our demands. So much of the food there is heavily processed, it's full of additives, maybe has a high sugar content, and it's sold mainly because it's quick and easy and because we respond to the heavy advertising such food gets. And it's really tough to buy a good variety of quality, basic, unprocessed foods in the average supermarket. I doubt if we could serve the food we serve at Holden if we had to shop in the Safeway at Chelan. If supermarket food is a response to our demands for certain types of food, then I think we're in trouble. I think our willingness to settle for very little when it comes to food is also easily seen in restaurants. Most restaurants are now fast food places. For example, if you came in through Wenatchee's Main Street, or if you go out that way, you'll see restaurant after fast food restaurant. There's Sambo's, Country Kitchen, Kentucky Fried Chicken, McDonald's, A&W. Every chain is there, every major chain, but it's almost impossible in Wenatchee to find a restaurant where you can get good quality food at an affordable price. And overall, I think in America it's true that only a small number of restaurants today are truly places where one can get a good meal at an affordable price. Percentage-wise, most restaurants are poor fast food places. And the settling for less both at home and away from home has several side effects that I can see. For one thing, I think we support much waste when we eat poorly at home or in restaurants. In the processing of this food, in its packaging, for example, the packaging in stores designed to sell foods or McDonald's packaging, we waste many natural resources, mainly trees. And then in amounts of usable food, we waste a lot. Things that are left over that are convenience foods don't lend themselves to being used as leftovers, simply become thrown away. Also nutritionally, we don't get what we need from such food. And then we end up, instead of getting our nutrition from good food, trying to get it maybe from eating even more junk foods, or we take vitamins to fill in the gaps. Hand in hand with bad nutrition comes food-linked diseases. And I think these are mainly obesity, heart disease, and cancer. another thing that has less to do with our physical health is I think that when we eat food like this, general American food, which usually ends up being the quick, easy, prepared type, and then be on the run again, I think we have less time together. And I think our meal times are less and less a time for people to sit down together and share with each other. And I think most people don't often linger with each other over meals. And I think there's much to be gained from that, much richness. I think America's eating habits raise hard questions of right and wrong as well. For example, we eat so many potato chips and crackers and cookies, and these things are eaten by the millions every day here. But yet the flour used for these things could make bread for many hungry people in a very hungry world. And there are things like this we just can't get away from thinking about. And all of what I've just said is nothing new at all. I'm sure you've all heard it a million times. And most people are completely aware of it. And then many people also know that we need to change things. And I think many of us are really trying to change. And in fact, so many people are trying to live simply and to eat simply that it's become another giant big business. Simple living has. And because we don't have enough information and don't know where to start with any changes we want to make, we can now buy healthy foods that are really only junk foods in new forms. For example, you can buy granola and muesli from Kellogg's cereal. And if you read on the side of the box what's in there, you find out that it's not quite so healthy as you think it might be from the name of it. Or we can buy brown rice mix from Uncle Ben's that has a very high percentage of sugar and other chemicals. Or we buy turkey hot dogs because maybe we want to eat less red meat. We don't want to eat so much beef, but the turkey hot dogs are just as full of chemicals as the beef hot dogs. Or we buy yogurt that already comes with plenty of sugar and canned fruit in it. And we pay more for foods marked organic, although they aren't at all different from the same things that are unmarked. And because we lack this information, our good intentions often are shaped by the fads that come and go. And right now, food and living simply and eating well is a giant fad. And I think many of the things that people are doing today simply grow out of this current fad. And I wonder what we'll be eating in 3 years. We hope that our style of eating here is not a fad, that it's a wise style, and it's a style that makes as much possible out of food as can be made out of it. And our style here has been developed by a group of cooks over the past 4 or 5 years. And we've been trying to find a style that serves food that's as good nutritionally as we can make it, and that adds to our enjoyment through taste, textures, and colors, and that also adds to our sharing and being with one another. And Holden is a place that exists to give people ideas to take home, and to give them ideas that can enrich their lives at home. And breaking bread together can be a very enriching thing, both nutritionally and as far as relationships go. And we hope that you can get some ideas when you break our bread here at Holden. And now Ethan has a few thoughts about some practical implications that a style of eating such as we have would have for you if you decide to try such a style at home.
A lot of things I'm going to be saying kind of tie in with what Will says, or maybe repeat some of it. But I will be talking about ideas behind our kitchen, things that we've thought of in the past, or the other cooks that have cooked at Holden have thought of, and why we eat the way we do. I think one of the major ideas behind the kitchen is the idea of rich and simple. Simple being, most of our meals are maintenance meals. They're good nutritionally, but they aren't extravaganzas. They aren't something that we put, 5 or 6 courses on your table. But they're good soups, good bread, good salads. So, you get your nutrition out of them, and you get the chance to fellowship with the people you're sitting with, but you don't get 5 or 6 courses. The idea of rich means that there are reasons for celebration, and we, being in the kitchen, believe that our food can be a way of celebrating. It's some place that we all gather. We all eat every day, or most of us do. Some of us fast, as Gertrude will talk about later. But you know, the majority of the time we eat every day, so it's a good place to gather with our friends, people that we share things with. And when there's a time or a reason for celebration, like Sunday, celebrating the end of a week, or looking forward to Eucharist, or on a day like our Christmas in July, or Christmas in December, there's reasons for celebration, so we like to do that through our food. Another idea behind our cooking is that we cook and serve common sense foods. We try not to stay up with current fads or be affected by them, but you know, as we buy our food and as we live our lives in the, you know, in the real world, as we call it, we're affected by this, and there's an impact on the fads that go around. So we try to stay away from it, and we try to keep our common sense about this, the kinds of food we serve. This summer, I've only been cooking for about 3 years. Will's been cooking for more than that, and Dave Christian, the other cook, has also been cooking for 3 years. We're pretty new at the game, especially you know, in the sense of large institutional cooking. So we're learning things all the time. That means there's things that we do now that we may look back at and say, you know, why did we do that? You know, this isn't an absolute thing. It isn't the best way to eat. And, you know, we aren't trying to tell you that. But what we serve now makes sense to us now. We don't serve meat every day. We don't serve red meats every day anyway. All of our meals are nutritionally sound. The soups that we might serve that don't have meat in them, we've prepared from a stock that we boil down bones and vegetable ends and cuttings. So they have a lot of nutritional value, even though you don't bite into a piece of red meat. We don't serve refined sugars very often in the forms of dessert. We use sugars very sparingly. Right now we're out of sugar in the village, but you probably won't notice it. And there's a lot of reasons for that. There's only been a 200 year history of refined sugar, or somewhere around that time. And since that time, we've just built up our use in large quantities of sugar, so that we're consuming a lot more than people in the past have. And since we've only had 200 year of refined sugar, our bodies haven't been able to adjust to that amount of input. So you know, you don't really know what that sugar does to you. So we're trying to stay away from that. Another thing that that we'd like to point out is that we use all parts of our food. If we serve carrot and celery sticks, we cut off the ends and we throw those in the stock. So those don't get wasted. We don't throw them in the garbage can. Things that do get into the wet garbage, we put into a compost. Thanks, Will. Compost to use to build up the soil around here. So we use these stocks for soups and sauces. But then there comes time when our philosophy breaks down. There's holes in it. We serve ham, which is full of chemicals. They use the chemicals as color enhancers and also for preservatives. We buy tomatoes that come from Mexico, where farm workers are exploited. You know, there's just scads and scads of ways that our philosophy breaks down. And you know, somehow we have to live with that. We look at that we're feeding 400 people here every meal, and we have to buy through the the houses that are available, the wholesale houses that are available, and there just isn't any easy way to get around it. So, you know, like everyone else, there's holes in all of our lives as far as contradictions from our philosophies and our living. So we live with that, and then we look at alternatives, feasible alternatives, and when those come about, you know, then we can jump at the chance. The third area I'd like to talk about tonight is that we operate a kitchen. It isn't a restaurant, and it isn't a food service. We feel that eating sensibly, or eating so that we use all of our foods well, necessitates a kitchen or even a family kitchen. And you know, when you go beyond Holden, that applies to your house too. We find it really easy to order foods because we just order general commodities and then we make all of our things. We don't order mixes, and you know, then when we look at our menu that's coming up in the week, we see that we have to have a mix here and a mix there. We don't have to plan for that. We just order general commodities and we make all of our stuff. We make mayonnaise, salad dressings, and then all of our coffee cakes and desserts and things are from scratch. We use all parts of our food, which in a kitchen, or you know, in a lot of kitchens in America, it just doesn't happen. Find you know, the fastest way to prepare things, when the wife and the husband work and they come home and they're tired, they try to fix things as quickly as possible. And that means that it's not easy to keep a kitchen going. And to keep a kitchen going, you have to have a, you know, things like stock pot going, where you use all the bones and all the scraps. Another thing that makes our kitchen a kitchen is that we all work together. We're not super efficient. We have very cheap labor. You know, everyone in there is a volunteer. So we don't have to make sure that their time is you know, spent the best as possible. But we have a lot of fun at the same time. That's, you know, part of our kitchen is people come up here not to work. They come up here to, you know, to reap the harvest of Holden Village, wherever that is. And it's different for each of us. The word work is kind of a foreign word to us. We don't say, oh, we're going to work at 5 o'clock in the morning. We're going to go in the kitchen, you know. It just doesn't seem the same, or it doesn't. The word work is very foreign to our vocabulary. Now, the last thing I want to say or point out is that we aren't in a great crusade to try to change everybody that comes to Holden Village to our way of cooking. The main reason I cook here is because I enjoy the way we prepare food and I enjoy eating the food we prepare. It makes sense to us, you know, where we're at right now. You know, that might change as we learn more, or as other opportunities arise. And the way we cook is an absolute. You know, it'll change. That's about the size of my story.
Thanks. There's a lot there to chew on. Rich Kemmerer in Vespers tonight mentioned the feast before our eyes and how too often we fast our eyes rather than our stomachs. One of the persons, some of you may not know, who provides feasts for our eyes at the village is Gertrude Lundholm, who is in charge of flowers, and she makes marvelous arrangements. Have you noticed them in the dining hall?
Thank you. It's kind of a surprise that I'm on this because I'm not in the, have not been in the group at Holden that's been participating on the fast day. But somebody heard me say that I had fasted for a number of years and so threw in my name with these people. So I'm on not as a crusader for doing any great thing. It's a thing that I did by myself that I felt was very important, and it happened because of a frightening experience. About 6 years ago, we were on our way out here and decided to stop and see my sister in California. And the night before we were to get to Los Angeles, we called her from Salt Lake City that we were arriving the next day and found out she'd gone to the hospital with a heart attack. And we stayed with her for a number of days and she had a second heart attack. And after that, I wasn't even allowed to go in and see her. But the first time I went in to visit with her, she kept saying to me, "Gertrude, don't let yourself get heavy." And she was a nurse, And I could see, even with her lying in the bed, that she had put on a lot of weight. And she knew herself, this is what had done the damage. And it was a very frightening thing to me to know that she knew better, but that she had let it happen. And it was necessary that Beanie get up here for his job. So when she had the second attack, and we were not allowed to go in and visit with her as before, we decided to leave for Holden. And I told her when I left that I would come back and spend some time with her, knowing full well that she may not even live until I got up here. But we did get up here, and I got called back in 10 days, and I got there before she did die. But while I was here at Holden, a pastor friend who was here gave me some books to read, and one of them, I took them with me on the plane on the way down. Two of them, one was called Hell Bent for Election, and I don't know if any of you know that, but it's funny. And it's about a fellow who couldn't make up his mind whether he wanted to go to heaven or hell. Most of the people that he'd met as Christians were not people that he particularly liked, and he couldn't see any reason for spending eternity with these people. It was good reading. And the other one was Not Me, God. I can't even remember the author, but it was a special chapter in there about a man who was, he was a businessman, who had these little encounters with the Lord in the morning before he went to work, and he didn't even dare tell his wife what was happening to him. And the Lord said, forget about it, don't tell her, I'm taking care of her, you just take care of yourself. And one of the chapters in the books was that he was to fast. And he thought, this is ridiculous, you know, my eating isn't going to make any difference in the world, it's not going to feed the children in India or any such thing. And he said, I know, that's right. He said, all I want you to know is for you to experience that the physical does not dominate in your life, does not overpower the spiritual. And I want you to take one day each week and fast. And because of my sister's condition and in reading that chapter, I decided to start the fast myself. And this is how I began. And I think I kept at it religiously for 5 years. I didn't lose weight, but all that time my weight stayed steady. And I did it all the time I was here at Holden. I would skip every Wednesday and not eat. And I either spent my time reading, or I would go down to 10 miles and have wonderful meditation by myself. And that was the way I spent my day when I was not eating with and in fellowship with other people. I'm not recommending it for you necessarily, but it was very rewarding experience for me, as well as helping me keep my weight down, because that's a hard thing to do here at Holden. Usually people gain here, and at least they have in the past. And I always found it was a problem that I would go home heavier than the way I came in here. So it was a help for me to keep this weight down in the summer, and especially that experience with my sister. I had one woman up here, she wondered about my fasting. She's a pastor's wife, by the way, and a good friend of ours. And she said, well, you should fast on Friday, not Wednesday. And Friday is the spiritual day, you know. And I said, well, I'm not necessarily doing it for a spiritual emphasis, although that's entered into it too, but I didn't start it with that in mind. I cheat on it, in fact. If I'm invited to somebody's home and that's the day she's planned a dinner for us or something, I'm not going to say, well, I'm not coming, because, or you'll have to do it another day because that's my fast day. I don't want to be, you know, make an imposition on her. So I change my day that week and do it another day. I'm not that rigid in the way I fast. Also at Holden, I've been known to go out and check the menu. If I don't like the day, if I like Wednesday better than Thursday, I change my day and I make my fast day Thursday. It doesn't mean I eat more, but I think, well, I might as well have the food I like and enjoy it when I do eat. That would be my feast of celebration, I guess. But I find for myself that it's a very helpful day. And I did tell him, too, that one reason I did it on Wednesday, I started, it was like when I taught school. And Wednesday was always the peak day in the week because you're half through, you know. Half of it's already over and you only got 2 days left to go. So it was kind of nice that, well, if I do it in the middle of the week, you know, I can eat joyfully the end of the week. I also had good days the first of the week. And Wednesday just seemed a good day for me to do it. But I'm not rigid in it, and I wouldn't expect anybody else to be, unless you really want to take it seriously. But that's how I started to fast, and I think it's a very good thing to do. I read lots of books on nutrition. My own children kind of grew up here, and I've changed my ways of cooking just the way Holden has because my kids do it. They all learn to bake bread here, and I have a daughter that makes soups from scratch, and they're much better than the way I ever cooked. And I think one of the books I read this winter was Live Longer Now. It was a top seller, and not all of it's good, but it really puts down the carbohydrate thing. And I never go in the grocery store anymore. In fact, I can't find a box of cereal that I really want that has the sugar content that's way down. It's always number one or two on there. So you go home and not buy the purchased stuff. You make do with something else. I make my own yogurt from the Holden recipe. Those little yogurt makers are wonderful, and I use powdered milk on that. That's the Holden recipe that's in the cookbook we had here a long time ago. I think it'd be nice to start another Holden cookbook with some of these new things that you have, wonderful foods.
Look at how nice and trim and pretty she is.
Yes. Well, part of that was medical experience again this year, and weight had something to do with it, maybe, except I hadn't gotten that extreme because I've watched it all the time. But that was another scare in my life where I really have to say that it's something I have to watch constantly. I have a sister that was 5'7", and I'm at the bottom of the pile. Being 5'1", and 10 pounds on me looks worse than 30 on her. You know, so it just shows very quickly, and I have to do something about it. So that's my reason for fasting. Now, I think the people that have been participating in the fast day at Holden maybe should add some comments to the fasting that's done here and why we're beginning to think about it. And we do it with some meditation hour, don't you?
Dorothy, do you want to comment?
First, I wanted to comment on a book we have over in the bookstore that's really helped me appreciate Holden's cooks and the Holden diet. And that is, I think it's Diet for Living, or is it Dieting for Living? Do any of you remember? We have it in the bookstore, and I think Mayer is the author. But I had really been looking for a book to just help me really get into nutrition a little more. And I find that this is just answering all the questions that I've had in mind for a long time. I'm really appreciating that book. And the more I read of it, the more I understand our menu here.
Could anyone pin down that title?
Here? Diet for Living by Jean Maillet, the nutritionist.
Would somebody explain or describe the fasting? I've been here since Saturday and I hadn't heard a word about it until tonight.
Let's see, is Jack still here? Or Dorothy, why don't you comment on it?
Well, we had a fast day last week, I guess it was, when we signed up on the board. We didn't sign our names, we just put our initials up there. We didn't have to fast the whole day, we could just pick one meal, we wish. A number of us did fast all three meals. And instead of going to the dining hall, we came over here to Koinonia and met together. And we had a Bible study, one session. We prayed in one session. I think the last meal, we had kind of a general exchange on fasting. The value of it, the purpose of it. And I really felt it was a good thing to do. But during the, I guess what we call the winter community, they have a potato day or a rice day. I don't believe that it's served for all three meals. I think it's just one meal where only potatoes or rice are served. And the money that is saved then goes, I believe, to World Hunger. Maybe someone else can answer that better than I. But actually, the part of the purpose of fasting, too, is keeping in mind the needs of other people and making food and money available for the hungry people.
Just one brief question. Did you initiate the fast here last week? Who would be setting out a sign up seat?
Yeah.
Two staff members.
Yeah, okay.
Before we get any farther, I want to tell a story about cooking from scratch. Karen Strum would be here. She'd tell you about one of the Vietnamese people that came to Decorah, and she was just so eager to get recipes from the Americans, and she was in a number of groups with women, and she said, "Well, I've been able to find everything, but where can I buy made from scratch?" Because everybody was beginning to talk about this again. She hadn't been able to find it anywhere. How do you make, where do you find made from scratch?
Bill,
yes.
I just take exception with one thing Will said about not being able to go to a grocery store and buy food like is prepared at Holden. There's another good book in the bookstore called Supermarket Handbook, and Nikki and Dave Goldberg, some Jewish name, I'm not sure what it is. They list all of the things that you can buy in a grocery store and give you brand names of what are the best to buy. Like if you're going to buy mayonnaise instead of making it, there are some brands that don't have preservatives that have really wholesome food in it. And I just took that book to the grocery store with me when I first bought it, and I just opened the pages to what I was looking for and went up and down, and just such simple things as if you're going to buy canned fruit because you can't get what you want fresh, there are, go to the dietetic or diabetic counter, wherever it is, where they have unsweetened kinds of things. But she claims in the book, or she and her husband claim it, you can get very nutritious food in the grocery store if you just know how to look for it. And it doesn't always come in the packages that you're used to buying, but I really think that's a very helpful book because they actually name brands as what's good and what isn't.
Hmm. What is the title again, Mary, of the book?
Supermarket Handbook.
Okay.
He and I talked this morning about, many people say, well, I don't have time to do all that. And I think that becomes a matter of where your priorities are. You know, if you're thinking of the long-term health of your children, for instance, or yourself, or your partner, or whatever, you have to decide, well, is it worth my while to have healthy people in my family? Then what am I saving the time for, you know? If you're using the package stuff and so on, are you really shaving that much more time out of it than you would be? Because it does take time to peel the vegetables and instead of buying them all packaged.
Yeah.
And the first panel over there mentioned the fact that heart disease and cancer and things like that went down, and I was wondering if David Rubin had a lot to do with popularizing the fiber business, and if you'd comment about that, what you know about all that.
I just know that from research that's been done that Americans have a higher incidence of cancer of the intestinal tract, and it's thought that it's because we eat so much food that has no fiber in it. And then it's also a fact that, that's about all I know as far as cancer. It's also thought that some food additives that are commonly used probably cause cancer. They've caused cancer in laboratory animals. And then it's a fact that 85% of adult Americans are overweight to some extent, and it's commonly known that obesity contributes to heart disease. And that's, when I first read that, that was a startling number, 85%, but then when you look around, you believe it. No?
But in that book, I don't know which one it is, How to Save Your Life, or whatever Rubin's book was called, I don't know if somebody maybe remembers, he compares the African diet to, you know, with the American diet, and says that, you know, in high fiber foods, the carcinogenic causing bacteria are in the system half the length. There's 35 hours as opposed to 70 hours, and that's one of the reasons that cancer is significantly less. So I don't know, maybe somebody else has read Rubin and stuff, but he's off of sex and on the food now.
Or have had experience with foreign diets too.
I haven't read Rubin's book, but one of the other tragedies of our supermarket processed quick service food is the hyperactivity level that has increased. And it's where
for someone who were active, I mean, at the time when a lot of us were growing up, there was not the incidence of hyperactivity that there is in our society today. And it has been quite, has been traced to the processed food and the additives and the red dye this, number this, and whatever. And if, I just read Feingold's Why Your Child is Hyperactive this last spring, and it's really tragic. If someone is going to try to feed their children food that has no preservatives, no dyes, it's to go through the supermarkets or even go to the health food stores, you have to read every label and you start reading them just out of curiosity. Read those labels and how much is there. And for the poor child who is hyperactive, if he eats one bit of food that has the harmful additive in it, it's 4 days of the hypertension that
Does he or she suggest that that is a primary cause then, of hyperactivity?
He is saying that it's not all of the cause. All people are hyperactive, all children are hyperactive because of food additives, but there is a large incidence of hyperactivity that is traceable to food additives and preservatives.
Comment or question back at the bar there? Yeah?
I just wanted to ask a question about preservatives. It sounds like you are saying that we can get along without them. And to produce enough food in the world, we have to have some preservatives, don't we? That's part of our... we couldn't keep food long enough. I mean, we can go back and try and preserve meat with salt or something like they did in the 18th century. We don't do that anymore. We have preservatives for meat to keep meat.
If you read the label, practically everything you buy has preservatives in it now, and they didn't used to have. I imagine most housewives can remember way back when milk used to sour, it doesn't anymore. And everything has preservatives in it.
I think we can eat in a style that makes our dependence on foods that are loaded with preservatives less. For example, by eating less meat, which has the effects of consuming less meat, which is dependent on large amounts of grain to put weight on the animals. By eating less of that meat, then maybe we eat eggs or find some other food source where there are at least a little bit less preservatives.
We do live in a chemical society, though. I mean, there are chemicals in all foods, really, aren't there?
Yeah. But then to try and minimize that.
I mean, you're suggesting even in unrefined foods, fresh you're suggesting that even in unrefined foods and in, say, fresh produce, we're still getting the chemicals, so
yeah.
Why bother, kind of?
No, I'm not saying why bother, but I don't think we can achieve a preservative-free or chemical-free diet and feed the world. I think that's one of the realities of nutrition in the world, or feeding the world.
Well, there are ways, though, that you can. You don't have to have an orange that's colored orange with a dye. Mm-hmm. And we can insist on having oranges that are all like the orange you pick off the tree. It doesn't have to be an orange orange. It can be the natural color off of the tree, and eliminate some of the nonsense that's put into our food. Through just insisting on what's natural.
You're suggesting that a good deal of it is just cosmetic.
Yeah. I don't know how much the picture has changed. We were in Europe in 54, and very few of the families, some of them had refrigerators, but most of them didn't. This was in Sweden. They didn't use them. They just thought there was no sense to store food in, and they thought they should go to the market every day instead of buying for the week and putting it in your refrigerator. This gave them exercise. I couldn't believe the women and the people, old women, who were buying, bicycling to market or walking to market, and they just went every day, that this was part of their exercise, and also they got fresh food rather than storing it up like we do, where we have freezers, and we think, well, we have to accumulate, you know, amounts to have on hand. They just don't do that, and so they didn't have the preservatives in meat either. It was fresh stuff all the time that you could get. And they had what they called a pantry, or they called it a chill scope, which is like an ice box outside your, you know, it was built into the wall and it stayed cool. But they didn't like things that were in the refrigerator. It was too hard or too cold or too frozen. And I think probably it was much healthier living, besides getting the benefit of the exercise every day.
Have anyone in here done any studies on the effect of chemical fertilizers and meat powders? Because every food that we eat probably has that in it. Does anybody here know anything about
that? Well, I think it's what's happening is we're getting small amounts in everything that's accumulatedly, it's a lot. We're getting a lot of things that we didn't used to get. Each little thing by itself may be okay, but when you put it all together, you're getting too much, and that's why these diseases are rising.
I think one of the biggest problems is that you can find a book to support just about any position you would like to believe. And some of the books are based on studies and others don't seem to be. There are other studies that don't show up in the books. And scientifically, the chronic effects of low-level doses of absolutely anything you can name are the most difficult questions to try to settle, because there are so many other things that you can't control that are having larger effects on the health of the individual involved. And so I think I could safely say that nobody knows what the effects are of small amounts of pesticides that may come through the food that you have very little way of telling. And if anybody claims to know, I would tend not to believe them. We speak of food as having chemicals in it, as if there were food that did not have chemicals in it. I'm not sure what definition of chemicals are being used, but as a chemist, any food you have is composed 100% of chemicals. Some of them natural in origin, some of them synthetic in origin, some of them more carefully separated from the other chemicals that are with them and therefore called refined, some of them not so carefully separated from the other chemicals that are with them as they come in the plant or animal source.
I work at an experimental farm at home which grows, mass produces raspberries and strawberries and fruits and things. And you can't have a large-scale farm without spraying and using the chemicals. It just would not work. You can't produce a lot to make your jams or send to market without the chemicals. So you're going to find them. But I think what they're saying too is, maybe buy the fresh strawberries with these, you know, a little bit of chemicals on them, and make your own jam, so you know what's put into it. Or, you see, so you're not buying from a store where they add all sorts of other things, sweeteners and things.
Mm-hmm. You had a comment.
Yeah, I think it's important to know that we have here in our midst a man who comes from India, where almost no food preservatives are used at all. And you'll find there probably less than 1% of the people would be obese. And heart disease is not really a problem at all. And it would be interesting to hear some of his comments on the food that he has eaten in India. And then he eats here in America for a couple of months.
Curry.
Or for a year.
That's why he said curry then.
I haven't thought about this for
myself. Would you like to just wait a few minutes? We can pick up on Paul's response to her comment if you want to just think about it a couple of minutes. Would you like to?
Yeah.
Okay.
Last week I visited a group of people called the New Jubilee Fellowship. They're the only organic growers in the Wenatchee Valley area. And they made an interesting comment that I never thought about before, I'd like to share with you. They maintain that it's no more costly to do organic gardening than chemical gardening. It's just that your losses are recorded in different areas. They grow enough, so if there's enough for the insects and stuff to get their share, so that there's enough left over for them to harvest. So their losses are in terms of sharing with the insect kingdom, whereas the chemical farmers have their losses or their added expenses in extra chemicals and machineries in that area. And they were maintaining that the losses are about the same in terms of your total cost. It's just a different way of looking at farming. I thought that was really interesting to learn to share with the natural order by planting more than enough so that you have enough to harvest rather than spending extra money to try to control nature and to try to reap the most you can.
Bill?
Yeah, I'd like to speak to Bill Cleon.
Okay.
The comment about you can read or hear almost any side and hear it authoritatively, I think is true. E.F. Schumacher in Minneapolis was, in essence, was given this, there you cannot do large-scale farming without chemicals. And he had two answers. First of all, the production per acre is not best with large-scale farming, and the last thing we want is to get into the bind where agribusiness is our only answer. So, first of all, he did not consider it a very legitimate question. But on larger scale farming, it is done without chemical fertilizers. It's done in other parts of the world consistently, and it's done in this country. I was in on a fascinating discussion in Arapahoe, Nebraska, where the new organic farmers in large scale farms tended to be either young or very old farmers, and they got together in the discussion, and it was a kind of middle range of the fathers, not the sons or the grandfathers, who insisted it had to be by chemical. But I think that's a very debatable question, whether you have to have chemical fertilizers to raise the food for the world. I don't think that's the final answer at all.
Can I say something?
Sure.
But when I'm saying large scale, I think on very small terms when I say large scale. We produce so small compared to the farms around my county, you know, because it's an experimental station run by WSU. And it's they use different chemicals to see what produces the best fruit and ones that can be shipped to market without being damaged, or what's the largest fruit, you know, what's produced, you know, and it's they use the chemicals to keep away the tent caterpillars, and you know, and what he was saying down there about producing, you know, twice as much or whatever, you know, so the bugs can have what they want, and then, you know, we take what we want. You know, it's fine, but if you don't have that much land, you can't, you know, plant, you know, a third more or whatever, so the bugs can take. You see what I'm saying? So the farm that I work on, I don't know very much about farming, but we use chemicals, and they try to use as less as they can because it is, you know, for experiments and trying to produce the best fruit. You know, so we don't go around using everything that we can get our hands on. But the fruit that comes off the farm is supposed to be the best in our county. So I don't know what kind of chemicals they use, but maybe it's not all that dangerous. I don't know.
Could I respond to you, please? Thank you.
Yeah, and then here.
I think the whole issue maybe is a little bigger than what's the best food or the use of chemicals and the use of something else. Now, granted, those things are really important, but, you know, and I don't know if this makes sense or not, you know, because I'm just kind of working it out. But I think it has to do with the whole issue of how we conceive of food and how we conceive of farming. I read a book that, by Wendell Berry called The Unsettling of Americans on Culture and Agriculture. And he's kind of addressing the whole agribusiness issue. And he's trying to deal with the fact that we've kind of used food almost as a weapon a lot of times. And we've used it as a means of competition and well, capitalism, I don't mean that necessarily in a bad sense. Well, yeah, I do mean that in a bad sense. One of the bad effects of capitalism, meaning it's become something we market and we try to make money off of so some people can get ahead, and it's
a real business, and we've forgotten that there are also cultural implications and ethical implications, the moral implications. For example, we all need to eat, and I think that's a right that we all have. And so if we're going to talk about food, about the use of chemicals, etc., I think the real issue we need to deal with isn't are chemicals good or bad, or do chemicals produce the best food, but they're simply how are we going to what morality are we going to base our use of food on? Whatever that's worth, that's my contribution.
You want to mention the book again by Wendell Berry?
It's called The Unsettling of America. Mm-hmm. It's on culture and agriculture. The subtitle is Culture and Agriculture, and the title is The Unsettling of America.
Footnote, Wendell Berry is a farmer and a poet and a novelist.
Excellent.
Did you have a comment down here a minute ago? Yes? No?
Over the Hemia.
Was it back here next? Or
the Hemia was going to talk again.
Yeah? Is he ready to go?
Excuse me. Can I ask a practical question from the kitchen? I was just curious on the food that you have left that goes into your stock pot. Do you also put in things that are normally... Two questions. You put in things that are normally not considered edibles. I don't know, maybe the greens from the carrots or something, which later you remove after the flavor has been imparted. And two, is the stock pot something that is always on, both taking in and taking out, it never spoils? Or is it something that you prepare, you use, and then you start a new batch?
No, usually for one day we save clean cuttings, fresh cuttings, and bones. And it's not something that's continual. We save enough one day to make one stock, and that
by
stock is used
up. You mean meat products of some sort?
Yeah, usually trimmings from roast and bones. And then things like onion skins, carrot ends, celery leaves, celery roots. We never use anything that's not
what's
fresh.
What's unedible about carrot tops?
I don't know, I never eat carrot tops.
You mean the leaves part? That's good.
But then...
Don't move.
But we use it in a way that you get the nutritional value out of it anyway, so it just isn't...
But most people cut off the carrot green and throw it away, but it can be used.
We don't even get greens with our carrots.
Yeah.
Nahemian, are you ready at this point to comment, or do you want to hold off yet?
One of the things I observed as a difference between we preserve food in India and here is that we are trying to keep the food in its natural way. Like, for example, most of the people prepare rice in clay pots. It is more natural and they can keep it in the same thing, same pot, at least 2 or 3 days. When you add more chemicals or when you prepare food with more chemical things adding, it has the possibility of more chemical actions than so reactions. A lot of chemical works going on in preparation. I have a feeling it has the possibility to create kind of diseases, I guess. But the people in India, they are very careful about that. They limit chemical works as far as possible. I don't know. Mm-hmm. The basic difference is this. They like to preserve food in its natural thing, and here a lot of chemical action.
Mm-hmm. Processing and so on.
Chemical
processing.
Yeah.
I'm going to Rappaport and I'm really for natural foods, you know, I'm not always crawling around kind of feeling. But every time I turn around, you know, they say that like they're not using any preservatives in India. And every time I turn around, you always hear about half the people in India are starving to death. And yeah. I don't know, maybe, it, I mean, I know they have a bad climate kind of, but if maybe that's the reason.
Yeah, I'm talking about the people who have food.
People that have food and people who don't, I mean, you know, it's just kind of...
Is that a direct comment? Otherwise,
yeah,
she's been waiting for a while.
An interesting phenomenon, I think, at least that, you know, talking about the quality of food, and people all around the world worry about the quantity of food. You know, where are we? With the quality or the quantity?
But I think the two are directly combined. Like I mentioned, all the junk food we eat, and that it's a fact that the flour used in that could feed many people. And that's something we have to look at. That old thing everyone's heard again, how many, it takes 7 pounds of grain to put 1 pound of weight on a cow. And maybe we should just eat a few cows less and give the grain someplace else. And that's where the political and moral implications come in. Our quality affects someone else's quantity.
My question for Patrick. First, I was wondering how you make your jam without adding too much sugar. When I make it at home, you use whatever it is, there's so much sugar.
In almost any recipe, you can cut in half the amount of sugar, or else use honey. And honey is still a sugar; it does the same thing as refined sugar, but
I use it and cut it in half, and then it gets so syrupy.
Yeah.
I add apple pectin to any jams or jellies I make, and then cut the sugar in half and use honey. But you have to add if you use Certo or something like that, you have to use a lot more sugar than if you just boil it without that. It takes longer to boil it down, but if you add pectin to it in some way and don't use the Certo, you can get away with half the amount of sugar.
I think one of the fallacies that the fads have, you know, brought to us is that they refer to sugar as white death and honey as golden life. But golden life, honey has twice the amount of calories for the same amount of quantity as sugar does. So, you know, you have to conserve on that too.
The other two questions, I was wondering how you made the fruit sweet juice sweet tonight. And then I was also wondering what was in the chilled soup on Saturday. I really liked it. I couldn't
The fruit was just ripe fruit. We didn't add anything to sweeten it. And I didn't make the soup, so I don't know what it was.
I didn't make it either, but a lot of our recipes by Joy of Cooking. And that chilled soup recipe came out of Joy of Cooking. It's chilled cucumber soup. It's basically cucumbers, chicken stock, salt, yogurt, and then a few spices. Joy of Cooking.
Margaret Rambar.
I have a comment.
Margaret.
Mm-hmm. Rambar. I mentioned the fellowship of the dinner and it being a celebration. And it seems to me, my personal opinion is that the meals around here are awful fast and rushed.
That's really true. And I wish people could all come in the wintertime, when every meal lasts at least half an hour. And when there's a bigger meal, it lasts an hour. But in the summer, we're faced with the fact that we have to feed up to 500 people 3 times a day, and we can only see 240 people. And that's true, and it's unfortunate, but we have no way around it.
That's part of the holes in our philosophy.
Yeah.
Second
setting.
Get around that by going to second setting.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But don't everyone come to second setting.
I had a comment to make on his
the comparison of sugar and honey, I think you had that a little bit backwards. The honey is twice as sweet as the sugar. They have the same amount of calories. The only advantage in the honey is you can use half as much to get the same amount of sweetness.
Mm-hmm. Also, it's a natural food and your sugar has been processed. The honey has not been processed.
Well, no, but he did it twice as many calories. It's teaspoon for teaspoon, but it has twice the amount of sweetness as the sugar. It has the fructose thing is the synthesis.
If I may, once again, the processing is not the adding of anything to the sugar that was not there naturally. It is the removing of some other things from the sugar, some known, some unknown, which were not there naturally. Mm-hmm. And I think it would be difficult to establish that everything that is removed from the processed sugar was good for you, and that the sugar that was there originally and is there in the honey is completely bad for you. Mm-hmm.
Comment?
I have a question about the 7 pounds of grain and the 1 pound of cow.
Yeah.
You know what the equivalent in protein is, because that's really the only important aspect about it.
If grains are eaten, I'm sure you've heard of complementary proteins, and if grains are eaten in combination with certain other things, it's possible to get excellent protein out of grains too. For example, we have a soup we serve once in a while. It's cheese soup. It's in the cookbook, either recipes or diet for a small plant, one of those two. And it's made from basically milk, cheese, flour, and margarine. Flour and margarine are really thick in it. And one cup, just one cup of that soup provides 60% of the protein needs of an average male. And it's just by the right combination of those ingredients that allow proteins to become complete, and they're then in a form that the body can take advantage of very easily.
Bread for the World says it takes 10 pounds of grain protein to produce 1 pound of beef protein. It takes 4 pounds of grain protein to produce 1 pound of pork protein. It takes 2 pounds of grain protein to produce 1 pound of poultry protein. And fish, it's just 100% pure protein. So if you want to eat lower on the protein scale, you eat fish or poultry and not so much green beef. But it's pounds of protein in grain to produce pounds of meat protein.
Then you get into problems with some poultry, turkeys I think in particular. They force feed them the last month and just shove a lot of grain down them so that they gain a lot of weight, so they go to market and they get more money from them. So. There's always holes in all these things, and you just have to find the best way around them.
Paul?
One of the dangers I discovered in becoming concerned about nutrition and eating better and complementary protein is that I can just stop with my eating better. And I think you have to take the whole question of food one step further and make it a justice issue in light of the whole world situation with so many people going hungry. But the fact that the average American consumes 3,500 calories a year, which is about 50% a day, which is about 50% more than we need just to sustain ourselves each day. So as a justice issue, if as Americans we can try to look at the way we eat daily in terms of consuming 50% less calories, I think that makes additional sense with our nutrition sense. And I think it's always important to think in terms of the globe when we're talking about food and not just in terms of our nutrition.
Americans also eat a whole lot more protein than they need. I forget the percentages, but mm-hmm. you know, they eat food what their body gives them. Mm-hmm. And then it's down to the grain, beef, and you don't really need that much beef.
Mm-hmm. And then the body simply converts that protein to fat.
You talked about your cheese soup, you know, with margarine and milk and cheese. Most of that has a lot of cholesterol in it. Are you just not supposed to eat as much, or?
Well, I don't know about cholesterol. It seems now there are ideas coming out that maybe it's not as bad as it seems. The way I figure cholesterol and food additives seems we either have choice of eating honest food that's not so processed and getting a lot of cholesterol and dying of a heart attack, or eat processed food and die of cancer. So take your pick.
We're all going to die.
I think the other thing to that is that it just showed me one thing, jobs and jobs and one thing,
right,
is important.
I think it's about time for a recess. It occurs to me, last night there were some comments about the hope of the future lying in our youth, and as I understand it, the most grumbling that's done about the food here comes from those who are teenagers. I'm wondering what the implications of that is.